Welcome to WKAR's Current State here on Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Lansing State Journal's Lindsay Van Hulley reports this morning we're getting a new stadium-style movie multiplex, 50,000 square feet, 12 screens. There's no timeline in the story. There's no opening date mentioned in this story. And Delta Township officials mentioned in the story, this is Mark Graham in the Community Development Office, say that no papers have been filed yet, no building permit request, no site plan, so let's not put the cart before the horse here. The chain responsible for the plan is the Regal Entertainment Group out of Knoxville, Tennessee, and it appears they're looking at the space adjacent to the Lansing Mall where the old Mervyn's store was and the Stephen Berry store used to be. So we'll keep an eye on that. On Monday, Barack Obama will be sworn in to start his second term as president. Nationwide, Mr. Obama received more than 70% of the Latino vote. As a group, Latinos are at the heart of the national debate on immigration, and they're sure to press the issue hard in a second Obama administration. Now, local advocates here in mid-Michigan are adding their voices to a national campaign to create comprehensive immigration reform. Dr. Ruben Martinez is the director of the Julian Zamora Research Institute here at Michigan State, and he's standing by to talk about local efforts in the fight for immigration reform. Welcome, Dr. Martinez, to WKAR. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
How exactly does the larger Latino community in Lansing define comprehensive immigration reform? What goes into comprehensive there?
I think at the center of that is a path to citizenship. That is the most important component, followed with reunification of families, which is also very important, and, you know, access, of course, to health, access to education, higher education in particular. So there are, you know, different aspects of life here that are critical to them. And so it's really, you know, beginning with legal presence, and then having some form of stepwise process that leads to ultimately to citizenship.
Now, does legalization as a part of this process, is legalization precedes the pathway to citizenship? Do I have that right?
I think that's the way it's being conceptualized, yes.
Okay.
That you know, you have to be given legal presence here in order to be able to begin to adjust your status, what they call adjusting your status, and then moving from there to a culmination point, which is where you are granted citizenship.
Right. Now, this would include something like the DREAM Act, which would give legal status to kids that are brought to this country?
Well, the DREAM Act, as I understand it now, pertains primarily to higher education, and that is those undocumented members who came here as young people, who went through our K-12 system, graduated from our K-12 system, mm-hmm. and are then granted in-state tuition rates in order to go to higher education.
So that's really a part of the pathway that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. Right. That's
access to education.
Access to education.
Okay. Now, does your organization, the Julian Zamora Research Institute, advocate a specific pathway to citizenship?
Well, at the at JSRI, what we do is we study issues affecting Latino communities. But, you know, out in the larger community, I'm a member of Mi Alma, which is the Michigan Alliance of Latinos for the Betterment of Latinos here in Michigan.
Okay.
And so they advocate addressing the issue of the undocumented, and that is moving, particularly important, is that now that the president has been reelected, that he is taking the lead, or said that he would take the lead on this issue, that we move forward in finding a way to actually come forth with some legislation, hopefully one that's shaped by him, that passes, you know, the National Congress and leads to a pathway to citizenship.
What is the local dynamic here of this whole conversation? How is this? How are all these issues playing out here in Lansing and East Lansing?
Well, we have lots of different groups in the community who are taking the lead in promoting the visibility of these issues and promoting awareness of the need for comprehensive immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
There's, for instance, the Cristo Rey group. There's a ministry addressing the immigration issue with Cristo Rey Church. That's one of the primary cornerstones of the effort here in Lansing. But there's also LACLA, which is the Latin American Council for Labor, which is also interested in this issue. But by and large, Latinos have a very keen interest in what is going on with two critical issues. One of them is access to health care, and the other one is the immigration issue. So there's not a lot of opposition, I think, in the Lansing community, or at least Lansing community, about toward these issues. But, you know, we do have the state legislature here, and, you know, repeatedly we have anti-immigration bills and proposals being submitted and discussed and sometimes addressed that we believe are harmful to the effort to bring about comprehensive immigration reform. And then, of course, there's the Michigan-specific issue, and that is that those kids who have been recognized in terms of deferred action, that is, that they're given legal presence so that they are not deported for a period of, I believe, 2 years,
right,
are not being allowed to get a driver's license here in Michigan.
Right.
So that's another dimension that I think is of concern to people here in Lansing.
I spoke with, speaking of the legislature and zeroing in this discussion closer to home, I spoke with Republican State Senator Rick Jones briefly yesterday for his angle on this. And he and others in the party feel that before we address the kind of reforms we've been discussing, that those in line legally should be taken care of. How often do you hear that? How big of a legislative hurdle is that attitude?
I think that's just another political ploy,
okay,
to kind of hamper and hinder this process. Where, you know, there's a lot of different approaches that one can use to hinder the process for really addressing the issue. I mean, initially on a national level, it was always enforcement first, and so forth. Now we are at a point that the nation is spending something like $18 billion on enforcement, and it is like $7 billion more than what we spend on the FBI, on the Secret Service, on the alcohol, tobacco, and these other agencies and so forth altogether. Mm. And so these are just tactics, I think, to try to hinder what we believe is a very important issue that needs to be addressed, but it needs to be addressed humanely. It needs to be addressed realistically and rationally, and it needs to be addressed on the basis of an understanding that these people are part of our economy.
Mm-hmm.
That they are being exploited by having to live in the shadows, that their human rights, their labor rights are being violated, that we ourselves are putting ourselves at risk in terms of public health, because by keeping them out of the health system, they may be getting sick and, you know,
going to the emergency room.
Exactly,
like, yeah,
and costing us in terms of health costs and so forth. So there's a lot of issues that we need to bring into this discussion and discuss them on a rational basis. Part of the problem is that over the last 10 years in particular, particularly since 9/11, the discussion over immigration has really become ideological. It hasn't been focused on serving the public good. It hasn't been focused on addressing the issue as a solvable problem, but rather on pursuing political beliefs, just on sheer adherence to political beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And enforcement's not going to stop. I mean, even if you make progress on comprehensive immigration reform, step by step, as you point out, enforcement's not going to stop, right? I mean, that's going to be an ongoing issue.
That's going to be an ongoing issue. And ultimately, hopefully, we can get to a point where we're not spending $18 billion on it and actually have one that facilitates what, you know, is... not only addresses the issue of the of those who are here, but also facilitates and addresses the issue of what we have to face in the 21st century, and that is, what is transnational labor in a global arena?
Are more Republicans re-examining immigration reform in the aftermath of the election? Attitudes changing there?
I don't know if attitudes are changing, but I think politically they're reassessing where they are with some of their positions because the American public has pretty well spoken on many of these critical issues. And, you know, if we look at the polls over the last decade, upwards of two-thirds of the American citizens support comprehensive immigration reform.
Okay.
So the people have said, you know, give us this. And hopefully the Republican Party and its members are willing to address this on behalf of the public good, on behalf of the nation.
Still no driver's licenses, though, as part of the DACA reform that was rolled out last summer here in Lansing. How big a hurdle is that proving to be? We're 6 months after that now.
Well, you know, people have dug in their heels, and they're now going to court. I think the ACLU has taken our state government to court to address the issue. So now it's going to be addressed in the courts.
I'm really curious, is there any kind of divide between legal immigrants and illegal or undocumented? Or do legally naturalized immigrants tend to support these reforms as well? Is there any kind of tension there between those two groups?
I think there might be some tension among some individuals, but basically, these two groups are so intertwined in terms of kinship, in terms of family, that, you know, that divide's not going to be a very deep one.
Okay. And are Democrats generally united on this?
I think the majority of Democrats are united in terms of being behind the president. I think there's always going to be some individuals who are playing politics with the issue, depending on what constituent base they have and, you know, where their jurisdiction comes from.
Okay. All right, Dr. Ruben Martinez of the Julian Zamora Research Institute here at Michigan State University. We appreciate your insights here on immigration reform.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming in to Current State. Dr. Ruben Martinez here on Current State on WKAR. After more than 40 years of searching, sleuthing, and waiting, Michigan corrections officials recently called off the search for escaped prisoner Jerry Bergevin. If he's alive at all, Bergevin, who would be 80 years old, is a free man. He fled a low-security prison east of Jackson back in April of 1969. Bergevin's granddaughter, who's trying to put together the pieces of his life, told the Detroit Free Press her grandma and grandpa were, and I'm quoting now, the Bonnie and Clyde of the 1950s. And for a look at this and a couple of other really interesting Michigan prison escapee accounts, we welcome John Cordell, who's the public information officer for the Michigan Department of Corrections. Hi, John.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me today. I appreciate it.
That's right. Why was Jerry Bergevin in prison in the first place?
Well, Jerry was a B&E artist. He was arrested on and convicted of 25 counts of B&E.
That is art.
Safe cracker in the 1950s. Wow. Busy guy.
Okay. And why did you finally throw in the towel on tracking him down?
Well, it's basically, it's policy and resources for us. We have a policy that allows us to eliminate people from detection or active search at age 80 if we have no contact with him in the previous 5 years. With Jerry Bergevin, we've had no contact with him since he escaped, and none at all. His family may have, but none from us. So
none since the Nixon administration.
Correct.
And how many people how active were you in searching for Jerry Bergevin? I mean, how many resources, how much time did you devote to his it's easy to assume it just dwindled over the years.
Well,
is that the case or not?
Sure. You know, initially, it's a very active search. But typically within about 48 to 72 hours, if you're not finding them, your chances of finding them really start to diminish. And especially in the 1960s when he escaped, in 1969, we didn't have the resources we have today to hunt people down. Okay. And with Jerry, he just never showed up on the radar again. And so it really becomes a yearly check for us. So, you know, we use some electronic data software to search finances and things like that, crime databases, and he's just never popped up.
You're on a first-name basis with Jerry, it sounds like.
We've been searching for him for a long time, and now he's discharged. So, Jerry, if you're out there, you're technically a free man.
Our listeners will probably remember one of the more recent escapee accounts. Susan Lefebvre was arrested and imprisoned amid some pretty confusing circumstances on a drug charge in the 1970s in Detroit. She escaped the Detroit House of Corrections in 76 as about a, was she 20 years old or so?
Yeah, right around there.
Something like that.
Very young.
In 76. And she spent until 2008 mostly living this pretty charmed middle-class life near San Diego, was finally picked up, sent back here to Michigan, spent a little more time in jail, but was released and did Oprah and did the Today Show and wrote the book and did the whole thing. And you worked on that case, am I right?
Well, our Absconder Recovery Unit investigators worked on that case, and then I did a lot of the media for it. This was a big media event. It was odd for us. We generally don't, when you're releasing a prisoner, have any media there. But we had national media for the release of Susan Lefebvre, a.k.a. Marie Walsh, and she still has a lot of support from her family and has gone back with the family that she established as Marie Walsh in Southern California and seems to be living a good, clean, and appropriate life as a suburban housewife to a business executive.
I guess she got dragged along to some sketchy cocaine deal back in the 1970s by a friend, was told, what was led legally to believe by her attorneys, I guess, that if she pleaded guilty, it would be a good thing as far as her sentence goes, pleaded guilty, and then found out otherwise, and then got thrown into DeHoko.
Yeah, she received a 10-year sentence on this, and she was led to believe it would be 18 months, possibly probation, and ended up with a 10-year sentence. And she admitted that she just couldn't take it in the Detroit House of Corrections.
Yeah.
So she hooked up with her grandfather to escape, jumped over a barbed wire fence one late evening after a formal count, and was gone.
Now, she came back, served some time, and eventually we let her out. Do you maintain contact with those people for any reason?
Well, she's technically still on probation for her escape. We gave her a 5-year probation for escape, and I think we amended that to 2. And at this point, she's discharged off of that probation, and so she's free of our supervision.
So she was convicted of a cocaine, or was it cocaine or heroin?
I think it was heroin.
It was actually heroin. Convicted of, I don't know, being accompanying, being there present when a heroin deal was taken care of. And over the years, she ended up marrying a financial advisor, as I understand. So, I mean, she just, gave cooking classes and, I mean, ended up blending into the landscape in middle-class San Diego amazingly well.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we, you know, that we fight and weigh. And finding these long-term escapees, you know, what does that mean for them if we actually find them, but they've lived this, you know, a very proper life and basically reform themselves, what sense does it make for us to come and get them? But there are people out there, like a gentleman named Roger Chipman, who lived a criminal life in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who we continued to search for and finally found with the help of the U.S. Marshals, who still was committing criminal offenses. So okay, that's why we don't stop looking.
Okay. How many people are doing this kind of work in MDOC's Absconder unit?
Well, we have 27 members of our Absconder Recovery Unit. The vast majority of them are investigators, a couple of supervisors and secretarial staff. But they're out there every day looking at cases, searching for active escapees and absconders, parole absconders, out in our communities. One good example, Mark, is Saginaw County, which in January 2011 had over 100 parole absconders. With the help of the Absconder Recovery Unit and embedded agents in Saginaw County, I went on a tour with them in December. They had 7. So this is working. It's a great program for us. The Absconder Unit, Absconder Recovery Unit does a great job out there of finding the guys that aren't reporting and getting them back into reporting status.
How many Michigan prison escapees are unaccounted for as we sit here this morning?
Well, as we sit here this morning, 24. We have one high-profile escapee that's still out there. He's a Colombian national. We think he's back in Colombia and couldn't get extradition on him if we found him, most likely.
Is that Antonio Restrepo?
It is.
Okay.
And so Mr. Restrepo escaped back, I think, in 1988.
Okay.
Oh, 86.
Okay.
And we have not seen him since. No contact with him. He has, still has an active warrant for escape, but no contact.
And he's been on the lam the longest, then, I imagine.
He's the highest profile out there that's been on the lam.
And what was he? What was he in for?
He was in for delivery, manufacture of controlled substance.
Okay.
He's a pretty heavyweight drug dealer.
Okay. Are there commonly held myths about absconders?
Well, I think one of the myths is that every absconder out there is committing new crimes. And while there are some absconders out there who are doing that, obviously, and it's our job to ensure that they're reporting again, most absconders, they fail to report for a variety of reasons, because maybe they smoke some marijuana and they're afraid that we're going to put them back in prison because they tested positive for marijuana. In most cases, we don't. What we do is get them into some counseling programs that stop that addiction or help stop that addiction. Or maybe they were fired from their job and they don't want to report to their parole officer because they think they're going to go back to prison because they lost their job. In most cases, we can work with absconders. If they just come in to their parole office, we'll work with them to get them back on track and under supervision in the community rather than returning them to prison.
I think Hollywood's probably responsible for perpetuating a few myths about prison breaks, too. I mean, there very few of them really involve tunneling under the wall and explosives and stuff like that.
But there are some that do, Mark.
Okay.
And
tell us one.
Well, we had one...
We got about 45 seconds, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so in 2008, we had three guys, or 2009, I think we had three guys that tried to tunnel out of Kinross Correctional Facility. It's an old military installation with a fence close to the perimeter, and they got almost all the way out, and vigilant correctional staff found them and stopped them.
How about that? John Cordell, we really appreciate your time here this morning. It's a pretty interesting discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, and good luck with the new show. We appreciate it.
John Cordell, Public Information Officer for the Michigan Department of Corrections. Thank you. In the second half of Current State here from WKAR, we check in with the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad on the Spartan men's basketball team and their contest with Ohio State. We'll talk a little bit about Manti Te'o and Lance Armstrong as well. And a couple of really talented local teenage figure skaters are off to Omaha for the U.S. National Figure Skating Championships. Current State's Kevin Lavery has their story coming up on Current State. This is the Friday edition of Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. MSU and the Mid-Michigan community celebrate the life and work of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. with a special pair of concerts coming up this weekend. Jazz, Spirituals, Prayer, and Protest will feature many musicians from the MSU College of Music and surrounding area Sunday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. MSU Professor of Double Bass and Director of Jazz Studies, Rodney Whitaker, heads the musical celebration of King. And WKAR's Peter Wharf joined Professor Whitaker to talk about jazz in the civil rights era and this weekend's event.
The MLK program, Jazz Concerts, started about 12 years ago as a way to further promote our celebration of Martin Luther King on campus. And it was hugely successful the first year. We had something like 800 people show up for 622 seats. So we decided to move into the format of having two separate concerts. And that's been very successful. We've had a steady gain in audience and support. But the concert is really about celebrating the legacy of Martin Luther King and bringing people in the community together. And so we've exhausted so many different things. And what we always try to do, and we always try to top the concert every year. And so last year we did the music of Stevie Wonder, and that went over well with the community. And I take suggestions from friends of mine in the community, and they said, you guys have never did Earth, Wind, and Fire. And so that's the direction this year. It's going to be a lot of fun.
What sorts of things will we hear on the concert, actually?
We'll have Peter Lightfoot, who is new to our community, who's a colleague here at the College of Music. He's an opera singer, African-American, and he's versed in African-American spirituals. So you'll hear him do some solo versions of that with Reggie Thomas backing him up on piano. Also, you'll hear the MSU Gospel Choir, which is a full-blown sort of Detroit, Chicago-style choir, and that'll be a lot of fun. And then you'll also hear the Earl Nelson Singers, who are a staple in this community. I think they've been together about 40 years. Their music is really similar to the Fisk Jubilee Singers, spirituals as opposed to gospel. Some similar things like what Peter Lightfoot would be, but in a bigger configuration. They have about 40 people in their choir, so it's a 40-piece choir. And then additionally, you'll hear the darlings of the community, the MSU Children's Choir, award-winning choir, celebrated, and they've performed with the Detroit Symphony. And it's always great to have the kids because Dr. Martin Luther King loved the kids.
Professor Whitaker, let's talk about what you do and connect the civil rights movement to jazz.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think what you have to remember is the musicians always had a pulpit in terms of the stage to fight for liberation. And in addition to that is that so many people, I think, in America got transformed because so many of their heroes were African-American musicians. So when you think about that, I mean, Duke Ellington, predominantly most of his audience was predominantly white. And those people looked up to him and they loved Duke Ellington, but he's African-American. So then I think through art, a lot of times people start to change faster than through social means. I think the music has the power to change lives. And I always tell everybody, we follow the King nonviolent movement. We changed the whole world with jazz, and we never fired one shot.
Can we touch on a few of the major pieces that come to mind?
Well, the interesting thing about Fables of Fabus, before Charles Mingus wrote that piece in 1959, actually Louis Armstrong came out. And although he didn't write a lot of music about civil rights or whatever, but he was the first jazz musician to really come out and speak about it. And that inspired Charles Mingus to have the courage to write the tune.
There was an incident where Armstrong was about to be sent on a tour, but he refused to go.
Yeah, he refused to. I don't want to pretend that I'm an ambassador of a country that don't show me respect And, you know, and if you ever check out 1963, Dave Brubeck actually wrote a piece based on that called The Real Ambassador. And he had two great pieces that featured Louis Armstrong. One was The Real Ambassador, but also They Say God Looked Like Me, which is really heavy, which is really, really heavy piece.
God created man in his image and likeness.
They say I look like God.
In the image of God created he man.
Could God be black? My God.
In the image of God created he man.
If I'm a man in the image of thee,
male and female created them,
could thou perchance a zebra be?
In the image and likeness of God,
can it be?
John Coltrane, the great tenor saxophonist, performed many benefit concerts for Martin Luther King in the movement. Can you talk about a famous tune by Coltrane?
Well, Coltrane in 63 was inspired by King's speech that his eulogy for the four girls killed in Birmingham. And he wrote a piece called Alabama, which was actually based on Dr. King's cadence.
These children, unoffending, innocent, and beautiful. Were the victims of one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetrated against humanity. The death of these little children may lead our whole Southland from the low road of man's inhumanity to man to the high road of peace and brotherhood.
In fact, you can go online at some point, and if you Google Dr. King, John Coltrane, Alabama, there's someone who's put it together so you can hear how it overlaps. But the piece is based on Dr. King's eulogy. And since in modern day, we've heard Spike Lee sort of put together, you know, the movie Four Black Girls, which is based on, you know, using Alabama as the theme for the event. But there are tons of jazz musicians that's been into the movement. For example, Jackie McLean did a great recording called Action. Ornette Coleman was doing free jazz. And free jazz wasn't just about freedom of expression of music, but it was calling for freedom. All these people talked about the movement, and they were involved in it, and they were serious about it. This event is really about bringing people from all cultures together in the idea that Dr. Martin Luther King expressed. I mean, when I look out into the audience, I see black folks, white folks, Latinos folks, folks from India, folks from all over the world because of the university community. And many of the folks that attend the concert never even look at each other outside of coming to the concert. And so in our own way, it is our way to bring our community together. Also, if you look on the stage, you see black kids playing together, white kids, Latino kids playing together. And that's what King was about. That's what we do in jazz. Jazz has always been about integration and bringing people together.
WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with MSU Professor of Double Bass and Director of Jazz Studies, Rodney Whitaker. The program, Jazz, Spirituals, Prayer and Protest, will feature many musicians from the MSU College of Music and surrounding area as well. That's Sunday at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at the Wharton Center for Performing Arts. Well, the Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad visits Current State every Friday and Monday. We appreciate that. Joe, for Michigan State University men's basketball, the going gets tougher with Ohio State.
Well, I think it's a huge game. It's the first of an incredible stretch for Michigan State. At this point, it would be 8 of 11 games against ranked opponents, although Wisconsin may join the rankings after winning at Indiana. So it may be 10 of 12 here coming up for Michigan State. You know, right now in good position, the Big Ten race, after losing that opener at Minnesota, the Spartans have won the games they should win. But now, you know, we're really going to find out if this team can contend in the Big Ten. It should be a really good game at Breslin Center.
And is the Dawson and Payne dust up behind us now?
I think so. It sounds like it was a pretty silly situation with Payne making fun of Dawson, his roommate here at Michigan State, for forgetting his practice jersey, shoving, got some punches thrown, police involved, a hole in the wall, they're going to pay for it. And, you know, they were joking about it even after practice on Thursday a little bit. So it looks like it's past them, but, you know, they need to make sure that everyone, like, does their dishes on time and all that. So, another incident doesn't occur, I guess.
They were saying all the right things late yesterday. I know that.
Of course. But, you know, I mean, I think Tom Izzo made a good point. You know, you can manufacture some things in situations like this, but the fact is they are roommates. And let's face it, roommates do have conflicts and they're around each other all the time. So I don't look at this as some, you know, deep-seated issue here. But certainly it was a case of some immaturity and an embarrassing incident for Michigan State.
What do you take from the Michigan win over Minnesota last night?
Very impressive, Michigan. Coming off that loss at Ohio State, you know, down 21 early at Ohio State, came back, almost won that game. Then to go on the road at Minnesota, which some people are starting to look at Minnesota like maybe the favorite, and really Michigan just really controlled the game. Considering Indiana's loss to Wisconsin earlier in the week, as I mentioned earlier, I think Michigan has to be considered the clear favorite in the Big Ten right now. There's so many players on that team who can make shots, and they just they play so well together really on both ends of the floor.
With regard to one of the most highly touted high school football recruits, and I'm speaking of Grand Rapids' Drake Harris here, is MSU still in the running, or is MSU one of a number of schools that Harris is considering now?
Well, I would say Michigan State's still in the running. When Drake Harris committed to Michigan State, the idea was he was excited about playing football for Mark D'Antonio and basketball for Tom Izzo. After the football season, he had a tremendous football season, and he's a class of 2014, so he's only a junior, but he started to realize that football is going to be his best sport, and I think a lot of people have thought that for a long time. So he's dropping basketball, and he gave this quote to ESPN. He wants to look at the, quote, bigger football schools. You know, Ohio State is coming after him hard. I would expect, you know, possibly Alabama, you know, Michigan, a lot of others to get involved. So at this point, you have to consider Michigan State in the running, but it's really not a good thing for Michigan State that he doesn't want to play basketball now.
And back in the day, sports was all about competition. Now it's a lot about scandal and complete surreality. Let's get your take on the Manti Te'o drama.
Yeah, really, obviously, a very strange situation, and it's just so hard. I mean, I think Deadspin did a tremendous job with the reporting on this story, and it's unfortunate that hundreds of feature stories on Manti Te'o and the the losses he suffered, no one got in touch with a family member of this, now that we know, fake girlfriend. My take right now is that I feel like he was honestly duped at some point. I don't think this is a hoax that he was in on from the ground floor. I think he was duped. And then at some point, I think he said, well, let's go along with it, unfortunately, and fed the story that, of course, was told so many times to so many outlets this fall. So I think certainly he was guilty to an extent of extending the story, but I just have a hard time believing that this was a complete fabrication on his part.
And finally, Lance Armstrong.
Well, Lance Armstrong finally comes out and talks to Oprah about the fact that, of course, he took performance-enhancing drugs for so long. The point he made that he didn't feel like he was cheating because everyone was doing it, level playing field. But obviously, to me, the bigger story here is just how many people he let down over these years. And as adamantly as he defended himself, it's really another in the sports world, it's a tragic fall of a hero.
No more coasting down the Champs-Élysées for Lance.
That's right.
Thanks, Joe.
Okay, thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
Je me baladais sur l'avenue, le cœur ouvert à l'inconnu. J'avais envie de dire bonjour à n'importe qui. N'importe qui, ce fut toi, je t'ai dit n'importe quoi. Il suffisait de te parler pour t'apprivoiser. Aux Champs-Élysées, aux Champs-Élysées.
Two young Lansing area athletes are gearing up to compete in the U.S. Figure Skating Championships next week in Omaha. 16-year-old Hannah Miller and 13-year-old Yvonne Mohov practice at a rink in East Lansing, and that's where current state's Kevin Lavery found them hard at work chasing their dreams.
Maybe it's the rugged northern stock she comes from here in Michigan, or something hardwired in his DNA that thrives in the legendary Russian winter. Whatever the explanation, local figure skating phenoms Hannah Miller and Yvonne Mohov are something special to see. I came to the rinks at Suburban Ice in East Lansing to watch these two teenage ice whisperers sharpen their craft. This weekend, Hannah and Yvonne are leaving their home ice for the 2013 U.S. Figure Skating Championships in Omaha. This will be Hannah's third event. She brought home a gold medal in 2011 at the novice level and took third place last year at the junior level. This year, she's back to compete at the senior level. A lot of parents in Michigan teach their kids to skate. It's just part of who we are. But 16-year-old Hannah is the crown princess of a skating family dynasty.
My dad was a hockey player for the NHL in the Olympics. My grandpa, my coach was my aunt skated, my grandma skated. My uncle skated, so a lot of people.
People like Dad Kevin Miller, who played for 9 NHL teams and was an Olympian in the 1988 Winter Games. Uncles Kip and Kelly went pro, too. Her dad's cousin Ryan tends goal for Buffalo, and cousin Drew is a Red Wing. Hannah's relationship with the rink is softer. It's ballet, not bruise. She masters the ice with grace. As she nears the end of her routine, Hannah musters all her concentration.
I think getting towards the end is one of the hardest parts because I'm tired at that point. I mean, I have 7 jump elements, 3 spins, 2 choreographed sequences. Just putting all my strength and all my power into those are some of the hardest.
Her aunt and coach, Kirsten Miller-Zisholtz, looks on. On this practice day, the critique is gentle.
When you're trying to bring the stop around, I don't think that the loop is always that good after it.
Kirsten because is herself a former competitive figure skater. She's here to guide her young niece to the next level, the senior division, where rank is based on skill, not age.
She's probably one of the younger ones, but I think there's 15-year-olds in the event as well. So she's just focusing on herself and her goals, and that is to do 2 of the best skates that she can and get her highest point totals of the season, and that's what we're looking forward to.
Across the rink, Yvonne Mohov is gearing for his turn. He's 13, and he's going to his second national championship competition. He skates at the intermediate level, one of only 12 men in the U.S. to qualify for the nationals. Yvonne's coach is his mother, Oksana Yakusheva, also a former figure skater. She was raised in Russia, a land rich with its own winter sport traditions. Somehow, she's found the balance between mentor and mother.
It's a hard. I mean, it's a hard to be mom and coach, but because I am skating all my life, like I was a figure skater, so I know how to, like, you know, step this line between mom and coach. But probably for Yvonne, it's more harder than for me, so.
Yvonne is a man of few words. Going into his short program routine, he prefers to let his athletic limbs do the talking.
What do you love best about skating?
I love competing, doing my best. It feels really good. I just go into the jump and I just focus.
Of course, Hannah Miller and Yvonne Mohov dream of their march into an Olympic stadium one day. For now, though, they're focused on Omaha. They're taking their training one step, one leap, one axel jump at a time.
Axel jump.
After she finished practicing her short program, Hannah glided over to where I was standing pensively, trying not to break my ankles on the slippery rink. We talked a little bit about some of the people she may come face to face with next week in Omaha.
I have some friends that I've been competing with, especially this year. Like Angela Wang went to Junior Grand Prix Final with me, so we're friends. And then Leah Kaiser is also going to be competing there. And then Ashley Wagner is the previous national champion who also competed at the Grand Prix Final, so she was a level up. So I got to know her a little bit. So I know a lot of the girls, so I think it'll be fun to see all them.
When you get tired or stressed or you've had enough of this routine, of this practice, how do you recharge?
I think just focusing on one practice at a time helps me, and just focusing on what I need to accomplish in every practice and not overdoing it helps me. And then along with warming up, eating healthy, getting enough sleep. And I also go to public school, which gets my mind off skating a little bit if I'm a little tired of it or stressed out about it. So I think that all kind of just puts together well and gets my mind off things that I'm stressed about.
Kirsten, you've been a figure skater. Are you still active?
Oh, no. That ship sailed a long time ago. No, I've been coaching for about 20 years, and I love the sport and learn something new every day and have a great time watching kids achieve their goals. So it's fun.
Your family has an incredible legacy with skating. Does that dynamic give you a competitive edge?
Well, I think that the whole family has competed at a high level. So everybody's there to kind of give her maybe their experiences and their take on how to compete. I mean, she's talked to Ryan before after the Olympics. She's talked to her dad, who's competed at a high level. And a lot of people have good advice for her, and I think make that a little bit more comforting that, you know, this is a hard sport and she's at an elite level right now and it's going to get harder. But just to keep that in mind, and it's a journey, it's not a destination necessarily, and just to keep working hard, and she'll have success, she'll have failure, but as long as she loves what she's doing and she keeps trying her hardest, we are happy.
Hannah, we'll come back to you for the last word. What kind of goals do you have for yourself in your life?
I've set some pretty high goals for myself, Worlds being one, Olympics being one, national champion. World champion, all of those are goals of most skaters, so just achieving those would be good, along with outside of skating. I want to go to college, possibly become a doctor, so I haven't thought too much about that, but after skating, that's what I'll go into probably.
Sixteen-year-old Hannah Miller and 13-year-old Yvonne Mohov are competing this weekend at the 2013 U.S. Figure Skating Championships in Omaha, Nebraska. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And looking ahead to next week here on Current State, we will have a piece on the Detroit Auto Show every day next week. If you're headed to Cobo Arena this weekend for the auto show, go to WKAR.org. Our Scott Pohl has put together a very cool slideshow from the auto show, so that'll whet your appetite. We have many people to thank for help getting us airborne on this first week of Current State, including Kathy Zell, Melissa Ney, Carol Carber, Tom Kinney, Bill Kinney, Mark Schwitz-Gable, and Jody Knoll. Thanks to Brad Walker for production help. Thanks also to WKAR-TV station manager Susie Elkins. Our chief engineer is Harold Beer. Current State's producers are Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and news director Kevin Lavery. The show is engineered by Aaron Young. Great work, Aaron. Emmanuel Berry hosts tomorrow's premiere of Current State Weekend. The program is produced by Joe Lindstroth. Peter Worf is the executive producer. A special thanks to College of Communication Arts and Sciences Dean Pamela Witten. Management oversight for Current State comes from WKAR's Director of Broadcasting, Gary Reed. Reed, thanks for your encouragement, vision, and drive in giving us the support to make Current State a reality. I'm your host, Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State.